From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1922, seven western states signed a water agreement, an arrangement to share the Colorado River. The water of the river is used by more than 35 million people, but things have changed since 1922. The economy, for one, there's more recreation going on now than farming. And the framers of the agreement didn't anticipate the massive growth in the West, tens of millions of people in mostly urban areas. And of course, they didn't have a clue that a warming climate would change everything. Today in the program, we're talking about the challenges facing the West as water becomes increasingly scarce. Among our guests is Professor Dan McCool, who says we're headed for a big shakeout, and it's time, he says, for a new era in managing the water of the West. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few weeks ago, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation announced it was going to cut the amount of water it released from the Glen Canyon Dam next year. These are the first significant cutbacks in the 47-year history of the dam. Officials say the last 14 years have been the worst drought period in more than a century, and Lake Powell is so low right now, it's getting dangerously close to the point when the turbines that generate power start sucking in air instead of water. But what if this isn't a drought? What if this level of water is, in fact, the new normal? Some water experts say it's time we rethink the arrangement that governs most of the water in the West, the Colorado River Compact. It's an agreement signed in 1922 by seven western states. The water is used by something like 35 million people. There are more than 100 dams along the 1,400-mile stretch. It's responsible for something like one-fourth of the country's gross domestic product. But, of course, things have changed since 1922, and one of our guests today says Western water policy today is hopelessly, irrevocably unsustainable. So today in the program, we're talking about the challenges of managing the West's water in the 21st century. We invite you to join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You can also join us on Facebook and on Twitter. Joining us first on the program is Brian Maffley. He is a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune, where he covers public lands in Utah. He's been writing about the impacts of drought on the Colorado River. And Brian, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Doug.
Well, here's where I want to begin, about the amount of water that flows into Lake Powell. Because you say it was incredibly low this year, and you talk about in your article how it really kind of stunned water officials.
Yeah, this summer was already forecast to have constrained flows into Lake Powell in the Colorado. When the numbers started coming in that the Bureau of Reclamation tracks, they were even farther off than what was anticipated. So what flowed into Lake Powell in July was something 10 to 15% of what it normally is for that month, and it just exacerbated a prolonged problem on the lake is the declining lake levels. They are now approaching an elevation of 3,575 feet.
Yeah. That's the cutoff point, right?
That's an important threshold in management of the Colorado River. And it became so apparent that threshold was going to be met fairly soon that they invoked these guidelines hammered out a few years back that required the releases out of Glen Canyon to be scaled back somewhat.
So if the lake dips below that 3,575,
yeah,
right above sea level, that's the cutoff point, I guess, or that's the threshold you say. And you also write in your piece that the lake level had been dropping by something like 3 inches a day.
Yeah, over the summer. And before I came into the studio today, Doug, I double-checked that to see what was going on the lake the last couple of weeks since I wrote that story you're referring to. And it seems like it's stable a little bit at I think, 3589. So right now we're 14 feet above the threshold. But it seems to have stabilized somewhat in the last couple of weeks. It's not maybe dropping inch or less than an inch a day. So it's pretty stable right at the moment. And of course that can change.
So they're going to be reducing these water releases. 750,000 acre feet. Put that in perspective. What does that mean exactly?
Well, an acre foot of water is the amount of water covering an acre to a depth of 1 foot. And it's the amount of water 2 to 4 homes will use in a year. It also represents 1/10 of the upper Colorado River Basin's share of the river. So that's a big deal.
Yeah.
That's basically, it's also the lower – it's 10% of the lower basin's share as well. Each basin gets $7.5 million under the 1922 compact you referenced earlier. So that means the lower basin is going to be getting 10% less than what it's due under that compact.
Yeah. Something like, what did you say, 1.5 million homes or something like that?
Yeah.
Give or take?
Yeah.
So how this is not – I should mention this too because it's an interesting part of the story. It's not just a matter of the implication for homes. I mean, I mentioned the turbines that – They're worried about that. I mean, that could really cause some damage.
I don't think it would cause damage because I imagine the turbines would be shut down before you get to that point. But that's a lot of lost revenue from an inability to generate power. And of course, downstream in Lake Mead, they have the same concern.
Yeah.
At a certain elevation, maybe 40 to 50 feet below where we are now. Right now, the lake level is about 110 feet below full pool. You get down another 50 feet, and the turbines will become no one knows exactly because they've never been in that position before. But the vortex action will begin sucking in air, and it can do serious damage. So what would have to happen would be the hydropower capacity would be shut down.
Yeah.
That's a lot of lost revenue. That power will have to be pulled from other sources, of course. So that's it's a big problem.
So where does this leave Las Vegas? How desperate do they seem these days?
Well, Pat Mulroy, the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, was making a lot of headlines last month. Suggesting that Las Vegas may be due for some federal disaster aid.
Because she compared it to the same kind of damage the East Coast experienced with
Hurricane Sandy. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right. And she got a lot of attention with those statements. And of course, as Professor McCool had pointed out to me earlier today, it's like, Las Vegas's problems aren't exactly a natural disaster.
They decided to build in a desert, basically.
They did. And so those remarks were made shortly before this long-anticipated decision by Bureau of Reclamation to scale back the releases downstream. So it kind of primed the pump for that rhetoric to get people kind of thinking about, there will be impacts associated with these cutbacks. Because they're holding water in Lake Powell, that means there'll be less water flowing into Lake Mead, a couple hundred miles downstream. And the folks that work for Pat Mulroy have told me that'll translate into a drop of elevation in 8 to 10 feet in Lake Mead. Of course, that puts their intake at risk. Not being able to pull water anymore. They have two intakes, and they're building a third at a cost of close to $1 billion that will tunnel under the reservoir and pull water out of the bottom. So if the water level of Lake Mead drops too fast, their intake might become the one that's currently usable will become unusable before they get their third intake built. So they're looking at some serious problems if present trends get worse.
You write in your article that all of this should spark what you call a paradigm shift in how the West manages and thinks about the Colorado River.
Well, I think that's the view of many in the environmental community.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's this attitude that groups like Save the Colorado or the Glen Canyon Institute are trying to get people to rethink is this idea that, oh, if we build more dams, more pipelines, that'll solve our problems, when in fact maybe they're making things worse. And some of these groups have suggested instead of even allowing water to remain in Lake Powell, let's fill Lake Mead first. That's a proposal that is getting pushed pretty hard right now. I don't know how receptive the state of Utah is to that. It would mean losing what's a very valued recreational asset. Of course, no power generation. But the advantage, according to environmental groups, are is that there'll be the water loss through seepage at Lake Powell will come to an end. They've hired a hydrologist or worked with a hydrologist to quantify those losses, and they're pretty substantial.
Yeah. It seems like there are plans, have been all along the stretch, I guess. There are always plans to, you know, get more of this water. One idea, of course, is for the water to help service a nuclear energy operation potentially in Green River. I mean, that's an idea sort of on the table. There's the St. George pipeline as a concept. Do you think these projects are pretty much off the table under the current conditions?
I think they're very much on the table when you talk to the people involved. Both of the projects you referenced would pull a lot of water out of Lake Powell or take water that was destined for Lake Powell.
Right.
The nuclear power plant would – I think that's in the neighborhood of 50,000 acre feet. That proposal is currently in litigation that goes to trial this month Emery or Carbon counties, I'm not sure which. And then the proposal to divert the water to St. George is about 90,000 acre feet a year. And the state of Utah seems very much interested in getting that project built.
Despite these concerns about
– Yeah.
Yeah. People are talking about how you find new sources of water. And there's this conversation that comes up about conservation measures, those kinds of things. But is anybody talking about yet, Brian, curtailing growth? I mean, are we at the point where that is maybe now on the table, this idea of saying we're limited? Starting to hear that
I think about that all the time, but I don't know if the political leadership of the state is thinking that way. I think growth is very much a desired outcome among our state's political leaders. But I have not heard much talk about the idea of putting the brakes on growth in Washington County, for example. I've not heard that.
Do you see a distinction between the way – I mean, Pat Mulroy, for example, you mentioned her, head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority.
That's right.
On one hand, she's incredibly engaged in getting water for Las Vegas. But on the other hand, she's also well respected for her conservation measures she's imposed.
That's right. They've been successful.
Very successful.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is there a distinction? Are you seeing a difference in the kind of rhetoric or language you're hearing in Nevada versus Utah? I mean, Nevada is very clearly dealing with water issues. Utah is too on some level, but it doesn't seem like there's the same kind of political language.
You're right. And their issues are so different. And a lot of it goes back to the 1922 compact that left Nevada with only 300,000 acre feet of the river's flow.
And no one thought of Las Vegas in 1922.
Yeah. And isn't it just beautifully ironic that the development of the river, the water and hydropower, made Las Vegas and the growth there possible. And now it's under future growth is now under threat because of the limits of the river. So then Utah, on the other hand, has gotten a share of the river that it has yet to develop. It has 400,000 acre feet of the river that it has not tapped into, which is what is helping drive the proposal for the pipeline to St. George, the nuclear power plant.
We've got it. Let's use it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thought is, well, we can build some. We can afford to build more dams on the in the upper basin because we haven't developed our share yet.
Yeah.
The environmentalists are kind of arguing, you know, there really isn't any more water to develop. We need to start thinking. That's where this idea for a paradigm shift comes through. We have to start thinking of different solutions, conservation, transferring water rights. Professor McCool can speak to a lot of those.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. But it's interesting that so we've been in this drought now for 14 years.
That's what they say.
That's what they say. So are we sure it's a drought? You know, I mean, what are you hearing? Isn't there some sense at some point that this is just the way things are going to be now, this new normal?
I think there is. The predictions from the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in their, you know, two-year projections or the data they provide that creates the two-year projections, you know, it's you know, more restrained precipitation. There's also a concern that the snowpacks are melting sooner. That's a problem. One geographer from the University of Utah, now he's left, Tom Painter, has done a number of studies on what is the impact of dust on snowpack. And is, according to his studies that he's led with researchers from elsewhere, is that it speeds up the runoff to the point that it's constraining flows into the Colorado. And he's calculated it's reducing the flows by 5%. Just the dust on the snow. And then you throw climate change and drought on top of that. There is a new normal. And that's why I'm a little skeptical to say, are we in a dry period or are we in a new normal? I just don't know. But it seems from what I've read that it's not going to get better anytime soon. And it's, you know, years like 2011, profoundly wet year, that was the anomaly. A record wet year followed by two record dry years. It's interesting. It makes me wonder when people talk about normal, what are we really talking about? We're talking about, I think what we really are talking about is the experience of the last 50 years, and our last 14 have been out of line with the past century. But what about the past millennia or 2,000 years or 3,000 years? Scientists have identified periods in ancient history that were, you know, this drought we're in was nothing out of the ordinary. And now we have a human-caused climate change on top of it. We are in a new era.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally. You've talked to one of the water policy experts you talked to in a piece you wrote, Brad Udall, said there's an enormous collision coming. And it's a collision between 19th century water law and the growth and the climate change of the 21st century. Is that where – I mean, are you seeing it too, this kind of collision where we've got to make some decisions?
I'm kind of not allowed to express an opinion, Doug, but I do think there's some tough decisions that are going to have to be made. And it seems the interests of the upper basin states and the lower basin states are pitted against each other. Where, you know, Utah's gain is Nevada's loss. And that's not conducive to finding solutions. The folks at Southern Nevada Water Authority like to say, they never want to say, oh, Utah's got to give up some. What they do say is we need to work together to find solutions that work for everybody. And it seems like pulling more water out of the upper basin that's a solution that doesn't work for the lower basin.
Brian Maffley, reporter covering public lands for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll put links to his articles on our website. Brian, thanks very
much. Thank you, Doug.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about water in the West. And if you look at the numbers, we seem to be in a prolonged drought. But what if it's not a drought, not a temporary condition, but in fact a new reality?
We're focusing the conversation today on the history of a water rights agreement that affects more than 35 million Westerners, the Colorado River Compact. And we're talking about these questions. Is it time to rethink that arrangement? Are we at a point in our relationship with water here in the West where something's got to give? 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. With us throughout the rest of the program is Dan McCool. He's director of the Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. He's also a professor at the School of Political Science. He's focused on water resource development. His most recent book is called River Republic, The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. It came out last year. And Professor McCool, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Good to be here.
Well, so we're going to be talking in particular about the Colorado River, but I wanted to get this out of the way because this is something that you've written about that you don't like writing about or necessarily just talking about individual rivers, just teasing them out, because you say that's been part of the problem in the West, that we need to be seeing rivers as a system. So yeah. Say something about that, if you would.
Yes. It's not only each river system, but it's rivers as a larger ecosystem. Part of the problem with the Colorado River Basin is that it was arbitrarily divided into an upper and lower basin. That's completely artificial. It's actually just one river.
Yeah.
And what we do in the Colorado River Basin not only affects people in that basin, but it affects people all around the area. It affects wildlife. It affects the economy. So for me, when we talk about rivers, I like to look at lots of rivers in the big picture. I think that's the best way to get an understanding of sort of the hydrological reality today.
I want to take note of the subtitle in your book, The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers, because a good part of that book is that we're in this kind of new renaissance for
yes.
rivers. There's good news to be had. For some river systems.
Yes, we abused rivers for over 150 years. We tore them apart and dammed them and diverted them and dirtied them and treated them like just a cesspool. And we're getting over that now. We realize that having an intact, clean, healthy, living river is a tremendous asset to a community, to a state, to the nation as a whole. So there are literally thousands and thousands of river restoration projects going on all over the United States, including restoration efforts of some aspects of the Colorado River. So even a river that's over-allocated as Colorado, there's some hope of doing some restoration work.
There's this attitude you've written about that over the last 200 years we had developed this attitude you called water hubris.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that and give us a sense. Are you getting a sense that we're getting over that?
Yes, in a painful way. Water hubris is this silly notion that we can somehow control water and conquer rivers and get water to do our bidding. Every time there's a drought or a flood, it proves that that's not true. And one of the illustrations I use in the book is there's a depth gauge on the upstream side of Glen Canyon Dam, and it goes down to a certain depth and then it stops. And I was there in 2005 where the bottom of the depth gauge was probably 20 or 30 feet above the level of the reservoir.
Yeah.
So apparently it never occurred to them that the river might not do what they wanted it to do. And that's true for the compact as well as the dam builders, that rivers have big surprises in store for people, and they always will. And we need to get over this notion that we're in charge here.
Do we have a sense one of the questions I was talking with Brian Maffley about was this idea of, okay, now this has been going on for 14 years. Can it officially be called something other than a drought, or is it, in fact? What do you think? Do we know what the new normal is yet? Do we have a sense of that? And if we, you know, are we accounting for finally mm-hmm. climate change, growth, those kinds of things?
Well, I've always encouraged everybody to just stop using the word drought. We live in a desert. Think of the drought. It's a perennial drought. This is drought city right here. But let's just throw out a couple of numbers. The the compact and the 1944 treaty with Mexico allocated about 17.5 million acre feet of water. The last 10 years, the river has allocated or ran at about 12, a little less than 12 million acre feet. The inflow to Lake Powell this past year was under 5 million acre feet. So what's the gap between 17.5 million acre feet promised and 5 million acre feet on the ground reality? And all the projections are that that flow will decrease another 10 to 30% in the next 50 years. You put that all together, and the current system of management, it just doesn't work anymore. That's beyond a drought. That's a whole new era right there. And we need some water institutions and laws that match the new era.
Let me ask you, in 1922, when the framers were putting together this water agreement that we're still bound by, what were the assumptions they were making about well, let me ask you about this. In terms of weather and water availability, what were the assumptions they had in 1922?
Well, we got to give them credit. They didn't have a crystal ball, so they did the best they could. Yeah. The West has changed in ways that no one anticipated, including the commissioners in 1922. But they envisioned a largely agrarian society. They never thought anybody would be so foolish as to put a city of 2 million people in southern Nevada. Of course,
they had no idea Las Vegas was coming.
No, Las Vegas wasn't even a truck stop then.
Right.
And they could not have imagined the phenomenal growth that's happened throughout the West, and the fact that Denver gets half its water from the Colorado River, Salt Lake gets a substantial portion, Nevada gets 90% of its water from the river, Southern California gets about 25% of its water, Phoenix and Tucson are living on Colorado River water. We've overtapped it to an extraordinary extent. No one envisioned that kind of overdevelopment and overtapping.
So I guess the sort of cultural context was this was for farms.
Yeah. Oh yeah. The assumption was that it was farming. Of course, that's supported by the prior appropriation doctrine, that the water law in Western states. But farming is now a small part. It's less than 2% of the economy in Utah, for example. I believe in California, where farming is huge, it's still something like only 12 to 15% of their economy. The big drivers in the Western economy today and in the Colorado River Basin are tourism and recreation and real estate development. That's where the money lies today.
Yeah.
They didn't see that coming.
They didn't see, as you mentioned, an urban landscape. Tens of millions of people in terms of growth, and many of them ending up in urban landscapes like
yes.
Salt Lake City.
Yes, and no one did. We can't be critical of them for not seeing this. This is unprecedented, and it's taken a lot of people by surprise. We've been fortunate in that we borrowed some time because in the 1980s, we actually had some very unseasonably wet years. Glen Canyon Dam nearly collapsed from too much water. And that bought us sort of another 10 years or so. But starting in about 2000, things started going south. And all the projections are there's going to be a whole lot less water and a whole lot more people. But keep in mind that people actually inside their homes for showers and in the kitchen, those sorts of things, in Utah, they use less than – it's about 5 to 10% of all the water diverted in Utah. So throughout the Colorado River Basin, 75% of the water goes to agriculture. And some of that is high value, very productive. Even if we stop subsidizing it, it would still make economic sense. And then a lot of it is highly subsidized and wasteful agriculture that would not exist if they didn't get checks from the government, frankly. And a lot of it is to grow alfalfa. The main crop in Utah is hay and alfalfa. And there's going to be – I call this the big shakeout.
Yeah.
Brian called it a paradigm shift. Brad Udall called it a
collision.
A collision. Yeah, we're all talking about the same thing here. The big shakeout means there's going to be winners and losers.
Do you feel conflicted about that, on this idea that it's agriculture? I mean, 2% of the economy is represented by agriculture.
Yes.
75 to 80% of the water is there.
Yes.
You yourself have talked about you'd rather see a hayfield than a subdivision.
Oh, yes.
These, it seems like these are the choices.
I love farmers. I love farmers markets. I love local farming. I'd much rather live next to a hayfield. Unfortunately, if we're going to have population growth, that's not the trend. That's just not the direction we're going. I'd love to see less population growth. I just don't see that happening. And so we're going to have to learn to live with less water. And fundamentally, that means that low-value irrigated agriculture is going to take a hit. That's just the reality. It's driven by economics and ultimately politics.
Yeah.
I think a really important thing to keep in mind here is that the lower basin has nearly three times as many representatives in Congress as the upper basin. So when we say it's our water, the heck with you over there in Los Angeles or Las Vegas, that is not an effective strategy. No one is going to let Las Vegas dry up, especially to water hayfields. It just isn't going to happen. Even if the compact says, well, Utah, this is your water, we're not – the federal government and the people of America will not let Las Vegas dry up. It's kind of an entertaining idea. I see the appeal, but it's not going to happen. So we need to embrace that reality and work with – in a collaborative manner with lower basin, get rid of this notion that it's upper versus lower basin and work together. That's the only way we're going to parse out these shortages that are coming.
Are you optimistic about that? I mean, it's been the hell with you sort of concept for a long time.
Yes.
Are you seeing that potentially changing in terms of the political dimensions?
Well, two things. First, If you mention revising or abandoning the 22 compact, all the water managers just become apoplectic. They just sort of go belly up and vibrate.
Unless you're in Nevada, right?
Even in Nevada, they still dance around that question. It's sort of the ultimate emperor has no clothes question. So we have to talk about like a wardrobe adjustment for the emperor here. We can't talk about actually doing away and the basic ideas of equity and everybody gets a share and we try to divvy up this water so that California doesn't get everything. But the basic notions there, an equitable distribution, those are sound. We need to stick with those basic principles. We just have to adjust it to the hydrological and economic reality of the American West today.
Yeah.
And if we can do that, then I think there's a solution here. We really don't have a water crisis in the Colorado River Basin. We have a water management crisis, and that is very different. That's a very different animal, and it's one for which there are solutions if we're willing to change policies and governing structures.
I want to get to those ideas for reform that you've talked about when we get back from a break. We invite you to join us, by the way. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dan McCool with us, a professor of political science and the director of the Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about water in the West and some of the challenges that the West is facing in light of
Well, a new paradigm, a new collision coming. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dan McCool is with us, a professor of political science, the director of the Environmental Sustainabilities Program at the University of Utah. His book is called River Republic, The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call from George in Layton, Utah. George, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Have either of you ever heard of NWAPA?
Oh, yes. That was the grandest folly ever conceived by mankind.
It doesn't look like a folly to me.
Yeah, they were going to take water out of the Yukon River and build giant dams all over Canada, and then it zigzagged all over the West to pick up votes along the way.
Yes, and the Rockies and the Bird River and the Mackenzie, and then link it to the Great Lakes.
Now, we should explain, it's the North American Power and Water Alliance.
I'm sorry, yes it is.
Yeah. Do you have a question about that, George?
Why isn't it being built? You know how many jobs this would build?
Well, he's clearly for it. Sounds like, Dan McCool, you don't think it's such a great idea.
I think that's the ultimate pork barrel folly. The important thing to understand about Western water today is that there isn't huge, vast quantities of unallocated water out there.
It's all spoken for the most part?
Yeah. There's 79,000 dams in the U.S. over 25 feet in height, 2.5 million small dams, 1,800 dams here in Utah. The cost of something like NWAPA would be astronomical. And the return on that to grow alfalfa would just the numbers would never add up. I mean, that's gold-plated alfalfa. We also have a problem that Canada may not want us to have all their water. And the complexities, the environmental impact of that, the economic cost, the impact on budgets, it'd just be outrageous. It's just a classic example of a very large, expensive project that creates a host of enormous problems. To solve problems that could otherwise be solved simply by changing our management strategies. We don't need a $12 billion project. We just need common sense water laws.
Well, let me go through some of these reforms that you've talked about. One of the first things you say is that we need to start managing the river as a system.
Yes.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, it's all connected. When a farmer in Wyoming in the Green River Valley diverts water and flood irrigates a field of hay, he's having an impact on people in Los Angeles. The law doesn't actually reflect that, but reality does. And we need to think about that, that the water that farmer is using could be used by a lot of other people under different use scenarios. Well, one of the things I've been pushing for a long time is as part of a system, there should be an accompanying marketing plan where if that farmer so choose, he could sell his water to the highest bidder. Then he could move to La Jolla because he'd have so much money that he could afford it and drink his own water down there. But we have to get more creative about thinking of it as we're all connected. We're all neighbors in the Colorado River Basin now.
Say more about that, this idea of a farmer selling his water downstream, this idea of water marketing from one state to another. Governor Leavitt tried this had talked about it anyway.
He did.
And it did not go very far. So was there a cautionary tale there?
Yes. He popped his head up over the wall and took a pot shot and then had to duck down fairly quickly. I think that was in 1996 that happened. It's actually a great idea. The part of the problems with the Colorado River is it's so overregulated. There's just rules on everything. And I think we need a regulated market in water in the Colorado River Basin. For example, the state of Utah has something like 200 to 400,000 acre feet of unallocated water, depending on how you define it. Sure, we could have more farms or use that for a power plant, nuclear power plant. We should sell that water to Las Vegas, or at least part of it. Their bizarre piping scheme to suck water out of the Great Basin would deliver about 90,000 acre-feet of water. We could sell them 90,000 acre-feet of water. They wouldn't build the pipeline then. Save them $15 billion. They could pay us the $15 billion. We'd get rich off of it, and we could use that money to lower state taxes or actually pay for our education system. That makes a whole lot more sense than building more mega dams or pipelines and such.
Well, what's the obstacle? Why isn't it a viable option?
Well, some people say the 1922 compact does not allow for diversions from the upper basin to the lower basin. That's one of the problems. But it's also attitudinal. For the last 50 years, the attitude of water framers in Utah has been, don't let California get it. And then when Las Vegas showed up, don't let Las Vegas get it. Actually, we do want them to get it. In fact, we should be selling it to the highest bidder and start a bidding war for the water and be negotiating with them so that we meet some of their needs before they take it unilaterally. Remember, they have three times the number of people in Congress. So we solve their water problems and we make a lot of money. If, say, a farmer in the Uinta Basin wants to put his water on the market for a sale or lease, we tax it. There's a local tax. There's a state tax. And the farmer does real well, makes a lot of money. The county gets some money and the state gets some money and everybody goes away happy. We need to start looking at regulated water markets that control for environmental variables and local impacts. But that's one way to solve some of our problems.
But we've never in the West looked at water as a commodity. That's what you're saying, is we need to start looking at it differently.
In some situations, right. Yes. It's also a public resource. So it has this – water is so unique. There's no other resource that falls out of the sky. So we've got to use it as a public resource that belongs to the people. But under certain conditions, it is privatized and it becomes, in effect, private property. And people should have the ability to, in my view, if they want to market their water, they should be able to do so as long as we control for environmental impacts and third-party impacts and such.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. George, thanks very much for the call. Let's go back to the phones. David is with us in Salt Lake. David, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
You kind of touched on it a little bit, but I'd like you to go into a little more detail about what each of us can do daily to really make a difference here and what the impacts of that would be. For example, in our daily lives of dietary choices, it takes 2,000 gallons of water for a single gallon of cow's milk, whereas soy or almond milk, for example, is a tiny fraction of that. It takes 150 gallons for a typical hamburger. You could literally float an aircraft carrier on the amount of water that's required to grow a cow, a typical cow. You know, what would the impact be if even just a fraction of humans here in Utah, for example, were to switch to a less water intensive diet? And is that a solution? I personally think it is, and I'd like to hear your guests' take on that.
Dan McCool, what do you think? It's so interesting because this is the West, after all. You know, there are cattle who graze, and this is part of our identity in some ways. And we have relationships that, you know, you want to keep with ranchers and farmers. Mm-hmm. You seem in some ways conflicted about this as well. But what about that?
Sure. Well, I don't think the government should be telling people what they should and should not eat. I think that's up to the individual. The government also should not be subsidizing all those activities. And one of the great mismanagement elements in this whole thing is that we subsidize all kinds of foolish behaviors, whether it's growing rice and cotton in the desert or alfalfa or having people live in floodplains where they're inundated by floods and we rebuild their homes. If we'd eliminate crop subsidies, it would virtually eliminate the water shortage in the Colorado River Basin.
Because they couldn't make it on their own, just based on the market.
Yeah, yes. We still grow a lot of corn. Corn is overproduced so much that it's in surplus, and the federal government actually pays corn farmers because the supply outstrips the demand, so the price falls. Just quit subsidizing corn, and it would dramatically reduce the amount of water that's used in the basin. Now, in reference to the caller's excellent question, if you want to eat beef, I think that's fine. My wife and I had a steak last night. I just occasionally go that route. It's good. It's good local stuff. But we should have to pay the price of that. We should not ask the government, or in other words, the taxpayers, to bear a portion of the cost of that. If we want to eat that way, that's fine, but you have to pay the whole cost of it. And if you want to reduce your cost of eating, eat less meat.
Here's another email from, I think it's from Vicky. How would starting an interstate bidding war for Utah's water drive up water costs for state residents? Which gets to a broader question as well, something that some water experts say we don't pay very much for the water.
Yeah.
And we need to change that dynamic.
It's incredibly cheap, and we should pay more. When I talk about water marketing, I'm talking about a willing private seller. In almost every case, that means a farmer.
Because they have all the water rights.
Yeah. We talk about income polarization in this country. Out west, we have water polarization. The farmer's got all the water. They are the marketing gurus here. They are the Silicon Valley of water sales here. So how much that farmer gets for his water would depend on what these cities are willing to pay. And the price is going to be big. I'd love to see a bidding war between all those lower basin cities for Utah water. The other element is the unallocated portion of Utah's water. And it would be a direct relationship between, say, Utah and Nevada to sell a portion of our water. The rest of the water that we have as consumers, say, in this valley, that's controlled by public entities, and it would not affect the cost of that water. But having said that, that water is grossly underpriced. The costs are hidden. They're subsidized by property taxes. Again, we should have to pay market price for that water. If you're going to use water, if you're going to fill a swimming pool or overwater bluegrass, that's your choice. But we shouldn't be subsidizing it. And how does that affect low-income people? I think there should be a guaranteed water right for everybody, a minimum. So if you're impoverished, first of all, you're probably not overwatering an acre of bluegrass lawn. Okay, you're probably using very little water, and your water bill is one of the smallest bills that you're paying. But in other countries that have used marketing mechanisms, they have something that's a little bit like food stamps, where there's government assistance for helping you pay your water bill if you really can't pay a very small water bill. So there's a solution to this that keeps our water reasonable, but we start pricing it like it's a precious commodity, which it is.
So it's interesting. I want to come back to agriculture a moment because you've talked about it. Even if we did, you've said that even if cities cut water use by 90%, we'd still have a misallocation of water, which sort of gets to this question we've been talking about agriculture. So what happens to this? You know, it seems like there's now this kind of emerging movement about smaller farms and local farming and urban farming and those kinds of things. Can we afford that?
Well, we're going to have to pay for it.
Yeah.
But we should be doing that anyway. And part of the discussion that is taking place now needs to realize that the way we've managed our water problems for the last 100 years is we had a big sugar daddy in the federal government, and they'd come out and they'd pay for all these things. And every time somebody said, well, we want a new water project, their congressman and senator got on a bandwagon and said, I'll get that for you. The federal government's $17 trillion in debt, they're not going to be building any more big water projects. Even if Pat Mulroy tries to get water for Las Vegas, I don't think they're going to cough up some kind of disaster aid. It's not a natural disaster, of course. So now we have to look at actually paying our own bills. And I think we're going to see cuts in subsidies to agriculture. So without the federal sugar daddy paying for agriculture and paying for water projects, we have to get serious about water conservation, using water very intelligently, and paying our own bills. And frankly, I don't see that as a bad thing. I think that's a positive development.
Do you think there beyond just there being political will to make change, do you think, you talk about conservation, when you talk about awareness, are you seeing more of that now? Are you optimistic about the fact that there is now an awareness among the sort of the public?
Yes. My whole book, River Republic, is sort of delusional optimism that things are really, there's this great thing going on, and it's not all gloom and doom out there in the environment. There's a good thing happening here. What turns people into water reformers is when they turn on the tap and nothing comes out. So the protectors of the status quo have some ground to stand on when the water's flowing. But when there's no more water, everybody becomes a reformer. You don't have to be an optimist to see that. You just have to be a realist.
Dan McCool, the director of the Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. His most recent book is called River Republic, The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. Professor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure being here.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The Moth and the Flame composed our theme music. Our thanks to Taylor Almond and Susan Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.